Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do you know your own mind? With brain research progressing at an unprecedented pace, scientists' understanding of the miracles and quirks of the human brain grows daily. It's happening so fast, in fact, that a lot of the conventional wisdom about what lies between our ears turns out to be wrong, like the fact that we only use 10% of our brains, or that brain cells never regenerate, or that people who lose a sense like sight somehow gain better hearing or touch. Keeping up with it all can be a challenge for those of us outside the field of neuroscience, but a new book has converted a lot of the most interesting new research developments into plain English, and it turns out to be a very fun read. Sandra Emmett is editor-in-chief of the brain research journal Nature Neuroscience. Together with Sam Wang, she is the author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive, and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Sandra, welcome to Think.
Nice to be here.
The point comes up over and over in the book that the brain really is this amazing machine, but it's also one that has a lot of odd quirks due to the nature of evolution and the things that we've sort of progressed through. We've got some archaic design left in us. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so you would imagine that if you were starting out to design a human brain from scratch, you might do it quite differently from the brains that we've ended up with. And that's because of the way evolution works, where it's easier to start with the pieces that you've already got. So there are aspects of the way our brains work that just aren't really completely efficient. Like, for instance, you might think that logic was a very natural way for humans to function. And in fact, that's not true. It takes an enormous amount of effort to think logically. And most people, most of the time, including very highly trained scientists and people that you would sort of imagine as being very, very rational, don't in fact do that. You can fool graduate students in statistics with very basic statistical puzzles. And the reason for that is that the brain is optimized to get a pretty good answer really fast instead of forgetting a perfect answer that takes a while to work out.
So there must be some value to these gut instincts that we follow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they clearly are what we need to get around, at least in the world that humans lived in for most of the time that our brains were developing. You know, you don't want to be sitting around saying to yourself, well, there's about maybe a 30% probability that that's a lion over there. You want to just scream and run.
So how do strong emotions affect memory?
You probably remember quite a bit more about your last vacation than you do about your last trip to the grocery store, even if you went to the grocery store more recently. And that's because strong emotions of any sort, positive or negative, increase the way that memories are stored in your brain. And that's probably because of the basic reason that we have emotions in the first place, which is that they help us to orient to the really important motivational structures in our world. They help us pay attention to the things that are important for deciding how to behave.
Without those things, we'd be too bogged down in the details.
Yeah. I mean, most of the time when you're trying to make a decision, if you think about it, you don't really have all the information that you would need to make a perfect decision. So if you're trying, for instance, to decide whether you should change your job, it would be easy if you knew how well you'd like the new job, how well you get along with the people you'd have to work with, how good you'd be at doing it. But in most cases, we don't know any of those things. And the emotional systems of our brain are very well developed for getting a roughly correct answer, which we think of as a gut instinct, but which is actually the product of a pretty sophisticated brain processing.
And we make these decisions feeling as if our information is pretty accurate and pretty complete, meanwhile not realizing that we filled in many blanks that we hadn't even considered.
Yeah, we have both filled in blanks that we don't realize that we've filled in and neglected enormous quantities of information that we actually do have in many cases. So to stay with the new job analogy for a second, if you think about how you would like being, for instance, a radio interviewer, probably most people would not think about all the time that you spend behind the scenes reading all these books and trying to figure out who to invite on the show, thinking up questions. They just think about what it would be like to actually be on the air.
Yeah, that makes sense. In other words, the thing that is most obvious is what we all sort of cling to.
Right. The thing that is most immediately apparent and also most sort of emotionally important, because everyone would imagine that they would feel most intense during that time that they were on the air.
So I have to tell you, I love the book. One of my favorite sections is just a little gray sidebar about maximizers and satisficers in making decisions. And having read this, it does seem to me that the world is very much divided up into two kinds of people.
My co-author says that of all the research that we did for the book, this is the thing that changed his life. Realizing that he was the maximizer type of person who we both are, who absolutely has to have everything just exactly perfect. I get into arguments with my husband about whether we should go this way or that way to the store because, you know, I say, well, you know, this way we're going to skip two traffic lights, and sure, it's a block farther, but it'll get us there 30 seconds faster.
But then you're also playing the game, what if there's something happening on the other side? You're trying to make these decisions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's the maximizer. You know, any advantage, any little thing that can be tuned to be a little bit more perfect, it takes up a lot of brain space and a lot of time, as you might imagine. The other style of decision-making, which psychologist Barry Schwartz calls satisficing, means that you just figure out what's good enough. You look around until you find an alternative that meets sort of your minimum criterion. You do it. You don't look back. And those people turn out to be quite a bit happier than the people who constantly worry about little differences that may, in many cases, be too small to make any difference at all.
Which is sort of surprising if you think about it, because you would imagine that people who were maximizing, trying to investigate every possibility and then choose the best scenario, would ultimately have made some kind of a better decision than the people who said, this is good enough.
Yeah, we'd hope so, those of us who do it. But in fact, there's a curious piece of psychology, which is that people's satisfactions with their decisions turn out to depend very strongly not just on how good the decision was, but on which alternatives they gave up in order to get what they did get. I had this weird experience in a restaurant the other night where there were four or five different things on the menu that really looked good to me. I really wanted all of them. And I felt like in order to choose one would require, you know, even if it was a really good meal, I'd be giving up four really good meals to get it for all those things I couldn't choose. And this is the reason that having too many choices can sometimes make people unhappy rather than happy, even if what they ultimately get is pretty darn good.
Because your brain will then focus on what you're losing as opposed to sitting there and enjoying whatever it was you ordered.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Are our memories of things as they happened the first time, or do we simply remember the last time we remembered?
So that's a really interesting thing that's quite new in neuroscience. It used to be thought that, you know, putting a memory into the brain was just like recording a tape. And you put it in there, and it was in there, and it might fade a little and get kind of scratchy the way an old tape does, but it wouldn't ever really change. And it turns out, both from psychological experiments and from work on brain recordings, that what happens instead is that every time you recall a memory, you lay it down again. And that is basically the mechanism by which memories mutate slowly over time, so that what you remember 5 years from now, you know, I'm sure you've had an experience where you and a friend remembered something that you both experienced in quite a different way. And it's not because either one of you is crazy. It's because your memories have been slowly changing with time in terms of your own personal slant on them as you remembered them and wrote them down again.
Even as they're changing, though, I guess if you have a lot of experience sort of reviewing them over and over, they do sort of lodge themselves more deeply into your brain, into your memory?
Yeah, I think it probably is true by the same token that memories that we recall more often are more likely to be put down in a way that we can remember them for a very long time.
Does that explain at all why people whose brains are damaged by dementia and Alzheimer's and other problems often are able to remember strong details about their youth and their childhood, but they don't necessarily remember what happened last week?
Yeah, so a lot of those kinds of disorders interfere with people's ability to lay down new memories. And so almost it takes an enormous amount of damage to the brain's memory systems before people can no longer remember what street they grew up on or who their best friend was or who their second grade teacher was. And that's because the longer you've had a memory, if you remember it at all, the better situated it is in the brain. So, you know, depending on the scope of the brain damage in a patient with amnesia, they may remember everything up to the day before they had their accident, or they may remember everything up to 5 years before or 10 years before. But usually, if you go far enough back, there will be some era of their lives that they remember quite well.
Do all people who have, my understanding is that the only way you can absolutely guarantee someone has Alzheimer's is to do a test after they have died from the disease.
That's right.
Do all people with post-mortem evidence of Alzheimer's, though, show signs of disease during their lives that would sort of correspond to the apparent level of damage?
That's a really good question. And in most, you know, most people who die of other causes don't get brain autopsies, I think is the short answer. But it's certainly true that in animal models of these diseases, there isn't a really strong individual-by-individual correlation between the types of brain pathology that you use to diagnose Alzheimer's and the memory function. So that remains an open possibility that there are some people who, for whatever reason, manage to compensate for this damage and not get visibly sick.
So now there are all kinds of books and tapes and CDs and games that we can pay a lot of money for that promise to help us keep our brains, our minds, sharper for longer. And you say, throw them out the window and go for a brisk walk.
Yep.
Why?
It's not that those brain games don't work at all. The point that we made is that, first of all, there is a lot of specificity to their effects. So, for instance, if it drives you crazy that you can't remember your grocery list, then by all means get yourself a brain training game that's going to help you remember lists. If you practice remembering lists over and over again, you're going to get better at it. And those improvements actually last quite a long time, as much as 5 or 10 years, which is pretty much as far out as they've been measured. They may even be permanent. The question is more for generalization, and for that, physical exercise is really considerably better.
Sandra Ammett is my guest. She's editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience, and her new book is called Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. You can join us with your questions at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. After the break, we'll talk about what it really means to be right brain or left brain dominant.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sandra Amet. She is a neuroscientist and co-author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. You can join the conversation today by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Sandra, what does it actually mean to be right brain or left brain dominant?
So this is something that there's so much mythology out there about that it's really hard for anybody to get the basic facts as scientists understand them. So, you know, the standard story is that the right brain is artistic, emotional, and creative and all these kinds of things. And that's only partly true. So when people talk about the right brain and the left brain, they're really talking about the cortex, which is about 80% of our brains. And the way that people have studied this over the years is that there's a certain kind of operation that has been done for epilepsy that involves disconnecting the two halves of the cortex so that seizures would not spread from one side to the other. And what the people who did those experiments have found is that in addition to the obvious thing we know, which is that the left side of the brain controls speech in the vast majority of the population, about 95%, it also seems to control most of the sort of logical problem solving and mathematical ability. So, you know, in that sense, you could say, okay, the left brain is logical, so the right brain must be the emotional side. But what turns out to be the case instead is that the left brain has such a strong need for logic that it's actually the source of what neurologists call confabulation, which is the making up of stories in order to have everything come out neatly. So this is the side of the brain that, for instance, thinks you saw a whole lot more than you actually did of that car accident. The right brain, on the other hand, is extremely factual, doesn't make things up at all, and it controls spatial perception and visual motor tasks. It's basically your more grounded hemisphere, more of a Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am, type of thing.
Wow, it's amazing how far off the conventional wisdom is from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we were all making up something to make it all to make it all fit together.
Those are left brain stories you've been hearing about what it means to be right-brained.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go to Steve in Euless. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Chris. Another great show, and I love my Think mug.
Thank you. Glad you like it.
My questions are, I have a memory device that I've used for, I won't tell you how many years, but it's a kind of a repetition by reading, writing, and listening, and in seeing my notes and writing it down, I'm using tactile, I'm using visual, and by speaking it even to myself, I'm using the oral, so I'm using different parts of my senses to implant in different parts of the brain the same information, and it seems to work for me wonderfully. I'd like reactions on that. And also, you were talking about differences in the brains of men and women and how they sort information, use information, and process information. And I was an anthropology student and remembered that this may be and have been implanted in the Neolithic. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, so the memory strategy is fantastic. The more, as you said, almost exactly, the more different parts of your brain you can connect to the same memory, the better your chances of retrieving it later on. So congratulations on that. And in terms of differences between men's and women's brain, this, of course, also is a hot-button subject that's got all kinds of cultural mythology surrounding it. But there are certainly some scientifically reliable differences. The two strongest are that men have an advantage in terms of spatial reasoning, particularly a task that's used in the lab a lot, is mental rotation, where you can think of it like having a object built out of Lego blocks that sticks out in various directions, and the test is a second view of an object a rotated view of the first object, or is it a different object? And that turns out to be very directly dependent on hormones. You can make women perform like men by giving them a shot of testosterone. So there's absolutely no question that that's biological.
So is there academic doping going on for the SATs?
I'm sure you have to get some kind of special permission to do this. But that's to give you a sense, though, of how big a difference it is. This is something we struggled with when we were writing the book. You know, how do you express the size of a difference? And what we settled on is that this is about half as big as the difference between men and women in height, statistically. So your average man is 5'10", your average woman is 5'5" in this country, and that means that 92% of women are shorter than an average man. For comparison, 80% of women perform worse on this task than the average man.
But not necessarily much worse.
No, not necessarily much worse.
Mm-hmm. I thought that the question about math in general was very interesting, in that men overall are often able to perform, are more likely to be able to perform brilliantly on a math exam, but are also more likely than women to perform horribly on the same exam.
Yeah, that's actually true across a pretty broad variety of cognitive functions, that men are just more variable than women. And the usual hand-waving argument that's given for that, although there's no real way to test it, is that the male population can afford to be more variable in some sense because the number of children that are produced in a group depends very strongly, for obvious biological reasons, on the number of women in the group, but not so strongly on the number of men. So we can afford to lose a few to the negative extreme in order to take the chance of having a few extras on the positive extreme.
Very interesting. And there's also a new theory. This is very interesting. A very surprising correlation between gay men and birth order that I had never heard before I read your book. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is really curious. And actually, I'd never heard of it before I started researching the book. But it turns out that of all the things we know environmentally, the strongest predictor of whether or not a man is going to turn out to be gay is how many older brothers he has. And that is presumably because there's some effect on the hormonal environment in the mother. The strongest possibility that anybody has right now, although it's not certain by any means, is that there is this Y-linked minor histocompatibility antigen, which is a factor that male fetuses produce and that has a role in brain masculinization. And the idea is that because the mother may produce antibodies to this and become resistant to it, and then with subsequent male babies may be actually shutting down some part of the brain masculinization process.
So the more older brother someone has, the more likely he is, according to this, to be gay.
Yeah, that's a very strong effect. There's no doubt about the fact. The question of why it happens is potentially pretty complicated. So it's about a 33% increase for every older brother.
Wow.
Which still, of course, means that a male with several older brothers only has about a 4 or 5% chance of turning out to be gay, but that's quite a bit higher than the first boy's chances.
And there's no corresponding effect for women?
No. In fact, almost all the evidence for a biological basis for people being gay turns out to be in men. It's much less clear why women would turn out to be lesbian in a biological way.
Is there a dearth of research, or is it simply that you can't apply the same kind of research to women?
I think it has been studied less, but the experiments that have been done have also been less conclusive. My guess would be that we're looking in the wrong place for women, that there's not going to be a direct parallel of this happens to men and the opposite of this happens to women. It's really very different because it turns out that if you don't have any hormones at all as you're developing, you come out female. Female is the default sex. So it takes active intervention from the default pattern to make a male. And that is a sensible reason to think that the mechanism of how that happens would be different in both cases.
So talking about differences between people, one of the things I found really interesting was the power of suggestion when it comes to how well people perform on different kinds of tests. And gender is one of them. Just by asking people questions about gender or race or certain other factors before an exam, you can affect their outcomes in a lab?
Very strongly. Most people have no idea how strong this effect is, but just by having people on the front page of an exam check a box that says male or female, you can affect their test scores by a significant margin. And interestingly, so if there are any young women out there listening, the way to get around that is to think about other qualities that you have, like, you know, being at the top of your class or being in an elite college, that bring up stereotypes that work better in terms of how they would make you perform. So the best way to get around that is not to fight it, but to just shut it off to one side and think about something else.
What's really interesting, though, is the idea, I guess the assumption is that women would perform worse if asked their sex, unless they're asked to focus on the fact that women might outshine men in a particular exam.
Yeah, so the effect is strongest if you tell people that the test was designed to bring out differences between groups and that their group is expected to perform worse. And, of course, the reason that just checking a box for female works is because we already, from our experience earlier in life, carry around these ideas that women are not supposed to be as good at math and so forth.
An email from Jim in Arlington asks, is it possible that certain people simply cannot learn advanced math? He says, I've always done well in all facets of aptitude except math. I was fine up through algebra, but after that, it literally became Greek to me.
Everybody's brain is specialized with talents for learning different things, and that doesn't surprise me in the slightest. I think some of it comes from experience. Some of it probably just comes from the way that your genetic potential has played out in your particular environment, but there's absolutely no doubt that certain kinds of learning are easier for certain kinds of people. And a lot of times what makes sense at a moment like that is to just let go of the thing that you're not so good at and focus on doing something you are good at instead of working very, very hard to become mediocre at something that's not your basic talent.
What's the relationship between nature and nurture when it comes to intellectual capacity? Where does the influence end and where do your genes begin, or vice versa?
So the way I tend to think of it is that your genes basically set your potential. So if we take an analogy to height, for instance, there is a clear relationship between the height of parents and the height of children if they stay in the same environment. But if the children, for instance, are born in a poor country and then they move to the U.S., then they will get taller than their parents, and that's because the environment has allowed them to realize more of their potential. And the same is true of intelligence. People always quote this number that intelligence is very heritable and that there's a lot of commonality between children and parents, and there is in the middle-class populations where that's normally tested. The tricky part is that if you go to a very poor or poorly educated population, you find that the heritability of intelligence is almost zero. It's no more than 10% commonality between parents and children, whereas in the middle class it's more like 60 or 70%. And that suggests that none of the kids in that environment are actually getting up to the level of their genetic potential where we would be able to see that they're inheriting it from their parents, because everybody sort of gets stopped short by some kind of intellectual equivalent of malnutrition.
So if you pluck somebody out of poverty at birth and put them in an entirely different situation, they have every bit as much chance of being the best and the brightest as anybody else.
Yeah, there's actually a study that's been done on that, on the children of American servicemen in World War II who had left behind kids who were raised in European countries who turn out to have done just as well academically as the children of their more fortunate peers, because they've been taken completely out of this environment and put into a new and presumably better one.
It's really sad to think about the people who get left behind in that situation. Is there anything that can be done once people are in adulthood? We hear so much about the limits and the windows closing and all that.
It's certainly easier to intervene earlier. It's not impossible to do it later. It's just harder. And a lot of the kinds of programs that have proven effective for, say, high school students have more to do with, or at least as much to do with, teaching people coping skills and good behavior as they do teaching them math and reading.
Sandra Ammett is my guest. Her book is called Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. We'll take more of your calls after this break. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. We will also get Sandra's perspective on the value of things like baby Einstein and baby Mozart.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neuroscientist Sandra Ammett, along with Sam Wang. She's the author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak next to Jeff in Euless. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. Love the show.
Thanks.
I was just wondering if your guest has found any information on the use of IQ tests as a basis for intelligence, and with judging with children, you have been speaking earlier of people getting left behind. I just wonder if there's any new research into that aspect of IQ tests.
Thanks for your call.
So IQ tests are actually a somewhat problematic way of measuring intelligence. They happen to be the best one we have, but they're by no means perfect. And one of the interesting ways that you can tell this is that, although it's not widely known, the people who make IQ tests have had to change the scoring about every 10 years or so, because if they hadn't, the average IQ would be now much higher than the 100 that is supposed to be the average. So, for instance, if you brought a child from the 1950s here today and had them take an IQ test, they would score probably 80 points. They would be borderline retarded, just a regular average kid, because the children in most of the industrialized world have been gaining on IQ tests over the past several decades. This is called the Flynn effect, from James Flynn, who originally discovered it.
Why are they getting smarter?
Well, that is a very curious question, but it ties back into what we were talking about before. It turns out that where this has been broken down, there was a study in Spain that I remember particularly. It turns out that those gains are almost all in the bottom half of the distribution. So the smartest kids are not getting any smarter. It's the kids who had been being quite badly left behind in previous generations who seem to be catching up a little bit. I think that's a cause for optimism.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. What are the organic the organic effects on the brain of poverty? We know the environmental, well, we think we know some of the environmental driving forces that cause people to, you know, have tougher lives and not be as good at school and all that. But are there demonstrable organic effects that are measurable by being a young person in poverty, you know, based on stress and things like that and what they see? And secondly, in the public school system, it's pretty much, with No Child Left Behind, a rote system right now. How are all the multiple intelligences, or the different intelligences, ways of learning, how can they be, how can their potential be unleashed given the rigidity of the school system we have right now?
So to take the first and much easier question, there almost certainly are a large number of effects on the brain of growing up in poverty, and some of them are very straightforward and obvious, like exposure to lead paint is more likely if you grow up in poverty than if you grow up with more money. Poor parents are on average more occupied with survival and spend less time talking to their kids. The people have gone in and measured the number of words per day that a middle-class child hears versus a poor child, and they find that I think there's about a 2-to-1 advantage for the middle-class child in that measure, and that is almost certainly affecting language development. And then, as you say, there's stress, there is potential malnutrition. All of these things very directly will influence brain development, and there is just now starting to be a community of neuroscientists who are specifically going in and studying these effects and trying to figure out how to ameliorate them.
So, I'm sorry, you wanted the second part of the question about the school system?
Yeah, you can feel free to cut in because I don't have a good answer for that.
Okay, well, let me ask you this about middle-class families. Middle-class families in industrialized countries, we can assume that their kids already have a number of advantages over their peers who may not have the same resources. And yet, these are the people who are going out and buying things like Baby Einstein, and they're playing Mozart to their pregnant bellies. Does any of this make a difference? Is that why our middle-class kids perform better?
That is my favorite brain myth. And the reason it's my favorite brain myth is because, unlike essentially all the other myths that we talk about in our book, we really know exactly where that one came from. Sociologists have studied this as an example of how myths propagate in society, and it's really quite an intriguing story. So there was a very short paper published in 1993 in the scientific journal Nature that reported that in college students, listening to a Mozart sonata improved performance on a complex spatial reasoning task. This was a very specific subpart of an IQ test. And the authors said that this was equivalent to an 8 or 9 point IQ gain, which sounds pretty impressive. They didn't emphasize so much that it only lasted for about 15 minutes. And it was in college students. It wasn't in babies at all. And gradually, over the next about 15 years, particularly punctuated by the publication of a book by a guy named Don Campbell called The Mozart Effect, it gradually crept in to being referred to as something that happened in babies and children. Nobody's ever tested that at all. In fact, somebody went back and tried to replicate the original result in college students and couldn't make it work again.
So it just was a good way for someone to make money.
I think it sort of taps into that basic American optimism that we all have. It appeals to people to think with so much of the way your kids grow up and what they're exposed to out of your control, it feels kind of good to think that there's some straightforward thing that you could do that would make them smarter, doesn't it?
It would be nice to be able to control something about them, yes. interesting question from Victor in Fort Worth. Do you think that we enjoy doing some things because we're good at them, or that we become good at doing the things we enjoy?
Both are true. You absolutely tend to enjoy doing things more when you're good at them. And in fact, doing things that you're good at is one of the most straightforward sources of happiness in the human condition, as, by the way, is being able to control things, to come back to what we were talking about before. But of course, if you enjoy something, you're going to do it more and with more often and with more enthusiasm. And practice, as we all know, is the way we get better at things. So it's a virtuous circle.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sarah in Richardson. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, I find this very fascinating. And I had a question about perhaps another myth, which is that right-handed people are left-brained and left-handed people are right-brained.
So that is also partly true. It's certainly true that your motor actions are cross-wired so that the left side of your brain controls the right side of your body and vice versa. But people who are left-handed don't, for the most part, just have sort of mirror-reversed brains. They have brains that, let's see, I think if I'm remembering right, 19 out of 20 right-handers have their language centers on the left side of the brain, and something like 6 out of 7 left-handers also have their language on the right side of the brain. So people who are left-handed actually have somewhat different brains than people who are right-handed in terms of which functions are together on which side of the brain.
I've heard a theory that some left-handed people may have started out as identical twins and been sort of as the twin split. Have you heard that theory?
It rings a faint bell, but I don't really know enough about it. They're probably, left-handers are probably not a single population of people. There are at least 3 different possibilities for how somebody can become left-handed, and it is probably the case that there are some of all of these kinds of people. So one actually is the mirror-reversed brain. That's relatively rare, but it does happen. And then another is somebody who has some kind of damage to their brains early in life that means that the right side can't support, the left side can't support speech in the normal way, that then leads them to, in compensation, develop left-handedness. That accounts for the fact that left-handed people are more likely to have neurological disorders than right-handed people, although the causality is probably the other way around. The neurological disorder comes first. And then there seem to be people who are just basically ambidextrous and end up using their left hand by preference, who are the most interesting group.
A lot to learn probably once we figure out where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go next to Patrick in Dallas. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I recently lost my sight.
I'm sorry.
I saw a program or listened to one on television. Some lady was blindfolded for a week, and they could see increased activity in the visual part of the brain whenever she would hear speech or audio input. Could you expound a little bit about well, let me just say this. It's always been my basic premise that one only hears better when they lose their sight because they just focus on sound a lot more than they did before, as well as, say, tactical sensation. So could you expound a little bit about what you know in terms of the reallocation of the brain when a sense is lost? Does this really happen, and how much does it help? Do you really get better at doing some of these things from another sensory point of view?
Mm-hmm. So that, again, is partly true. It's certainly true that the brain doesn't like to have big chunks not doing anything, and that if you lose one sense, that part of your brain will eventually be taken over by some other function. in blind people, what tends to take over the area of cortex that's normally involved in vision is not hearing per se, but language specifically. So blind people have, those who've been blind for a long time mostly, have much better verbal memory. They can remember stories and lists and all kinds of things that the rest of us have more trouble with. And the idea is that probably that happens because so much of the way that a blind person functions in the world involves explicitly remembering where things are. You know, did I put that glass on the coffee table? Where exactly?
Right, so whereas seeing people can just look at the coffee table to see if it's
right.
there.
Or they don't have to remember.
Yeah.
And they don't knock their drinks to the floor if they forget.
Mm-hmm. And how long does something like that take? Is there any research into when someone has recently lost sight as to whether or not that's able to sort of kick in later in life?
So changes in the brain in adults are relatively slow. So it would happen more slowly in an adult than it would in a child. But in various experiments like the one you were talking about a minute ago where people were blindfolded, I think about a week is how long it takes to start seeing the first glimmer of an effect, but it will continue to get stronger for probably several years before it finally peaks.
Sandra, why are there morning people and night people, except to drive each other crazy when they cohabitate?
Yeah, it's somebody's little joke most. Well, everybody's got an endogenous daily rhythm that is just hardwired into their brains. And this is why if you're in the habit of getting up at a particular time, you tend to pop your eyes open before the alarm goes off. It's because there's a clock inside your brain that tells you where you are in your day. This is obviously very, very useful if you're, say, an animal that has to get a certain amount of food before the sun goes down. And it's what makes you want to eat at a particular time of day and sleep at a particular time of day. But the clock is reset every morning by light, and that's because people's internal clocks don't always run at exactly the same speed. So some people, if left alone in a dark place for many weeks, will go on a 23-hour rhythm. Some people will go on a 25-hour rhythm, and it's speculated that your morning people are your 23-hour rhythm people because they're always trying to get their day to be a little bit shorter, and your night people are your 25-hour people because they're always trying to get the day to be a little bit longer.
So we just have to somehow reset the clocks. Sandra Ammett's book, co-written with Sam Wang, is called Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Sandra, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for spending the hour.
Yeah, that was really fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.